This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com. It's June, and we believe there's no time quite like the summer to enjoy some country music. BGS is leaning into all things quality country with our sister site, Good Country. This month's edition of Good Country highlights Artist of the Month, Jody Messina, and we have sit-downs with Braxton Keith, the Broody Brothers, and Ashley McBride. Dive in at thebluegrasssituation.com/goodcountry.
It's Cowboy Jack Clements line. We're in the business of having fun. If we're not having fun, we're in the wrong business. We're not doing our job. That's super important. It's the most inspiring thing. It's fun. There are things we got to do. We all have chores, and you got to do those chores. And sometimes you can find joy in doing the dishes or folding laundry.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life, lived in the in-between. Today, we're honored to feature our conversation with Jeff Hanna, the singer, guitar player, and founding member of the legendary Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, who, on top of being three-time Grammy winners, are currently in the midst of winding down a nearly 60-year touring career, which, up until recently, has continued to include hundreds of dates a year. In addition to his work with Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Jeff has worked with a veritable who's who of American songwriters, including Linda Ronstadt, Emmylou Harris, Johnny Cash, Steve Martin, and last but not least, his wife, Matresa Berg, who's written little songs such as Strawberry Wine and hundreds of other hits.
Yeah, and this was really fun to get to dig into such a long career and life. We really dug into the love and all the different ways that we can approach the process of songwriting and recording, as well as the importance and value of community and having fun.
With that, please enjoy our conversation with Jeff Hanna.
So we like to start with just how are you today and where are you physically and creatively?
Physically, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm sitting in our writer's room, which is, there's a lot of Matresa Berg BMI awards right over here on the wall. And, you know, some old posters and some stuff and a lot of instruments, a lot of old guitars and things that can maybe get you into the moment creatively. But it's also a great place. I mean, I love just sitting on this couch over here drinking coffee in the morning. It's probably the quietest spot in our house, the one that our dog doesn't come into too much. And I love our dog, Ava, so much, but she bunks her nose on the door and like, no, I'll be out in a minute. I won't say the W-A-L-K word, you know, too loudly. I've lived in Nashville now for since 1985, 41 years in April, which was, I'd never intended or thought that I would be here this long. I'm very grateful to live here. As you pointed out earlier, we have quite a community. It's pretty amazing. There are a lot of amazing people here. And having come from Los Angeles, actually from Colorado, this move was from Colorado, but Los Angeles is where our band got started. And we kind of came up in that kind of magic 1970s Troubadour, the famous club. That was kind of our clubhouse. Mm-hmm. And those were all our, you know, the kids we kind of went to music school with. And it was pretty special. But after people started getting record deals and hitting the road, we never saw each other because Los Angeles is so spread out as part of it, I think. And people's lives change. When I moved here, I felt a lot of that really great thing that I felt in my 20s when I lived in LA about that community of writers and like-minded folks. And there's no shortage of that in Nashville. And it does my heart good to see that and hear that. And whether They're folks that I've known for a long time, like Rodney Crowell or Emmylou Harris, that are of the same generation as me, or kids that are just starting out. They're so passionate, and they have their scenes. There are so many great, as you know, scenes in this town. So many mm-hmm. people sitting around talking about it, meaning the it usually is the song, which is, mm-hmm. to coin a phrase, you know, it's where it all starts.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that really resonates with us about this town is the community. We've been here for 12 years and Nashville's really exploded in that 12-year time, but it still feels like a small town all at the same time. And, you know, no matter how often we go out, I used to know everybody in the room and now I don't know anybody in the room when we walk in. But it's still, you know, the people that have been here for a long time, it still feels like a little community.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I love that about it. I do. Matresa co-wrote this great song with Gretchen Peters and Ben Glover.
Oh, yeah.
The three of them wrote this tune called Arguing with Ghosts, but the opening line in the song is I get lost in my hometown, which is a common theme for us. If we drive downtown now, it's like you're looking for, I can't see the Bat Building anymore.
Yeah.
I can't see the Ryman anymore. You got to pay attention, but a lot of growth. Fewer mm-hmm. cranes than there were a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. I used to call the construction crane the city bird of Nashville.
100%.
You'd see them all over. But yeah, that happens. I mean, every time I go down to the Station Inn, I have to be able to see the building. Otherwise, I'm like, where am I? What is this place? You know, and we've only been here a third of the time that you've been here. The Station Inn is still just the same building, one story, and then there's just all these monstrous skyscrapers around it now.
I'm always picturing, you know, that film Up,
with
a little tiny house in the middle of it. Yeah, and
exactly.
And that's what the Station Inn is. And I love what that place represents on a number of levels, you know. It's great that they haven't knocked it down. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, though. You were talking about coming up in the 70s in L.A. and at the Troubadour. And that's an era that if you're a music fan, we romanticize that era and read books and watch documentaries and love all the records that came out of it. But it's so interesting to think about how that was like a short moment in time for you guys who actually lived it. And there's all these different scales of that. You know, like last night I played at Vinyl Tap over in East Nashville. I haven't played a show in Nashville that isn't like at the Bluebird or Musician's Corner or something. I haven't played my own show in probably 7 years, which is crazy. And so I just wanted to like play a no pressure, not selling tickets, just like a neighborhood little local thing at the record shop.
We used to live right down the street back when it was the original Family Wash.
Yeah. And friends that came out said like, oh, this reminded me for us. We all like hung out at the Five Spot when we first moved to town 12 years ago. And everybody was there. That's how we made all of our friends. And it's the same thing. Everybody like grows up, goes on tour where you tour more than you play your town, even if you live in a music city.
Right.
And like life just kind of takes you away. And for me, it's been this process of like wanting to get back to basics of I started to kind of lose the love of the music because the business was just like getting me down and grossing me out. And like, just I'm curious to hear from you what your experience has been of like having that really magical time where you guys all are just brought in together with dreams and the love of music. And then also it going on to like crazy levels of stardom and success and all of that stuff for varying degrees for different people and how that changes people and changes your relationships to each other and as well to the music.
That's a big, really big question. Well, as you said, and I'm glad to hear your point of view about how the Five Spot was your Troubadour, kind of, you know, that's a beautiful thing. And you find your people. And as I noticed, and I'm sure you're aware of, and I'm sure you guys had the experience of like, you got to pick up the phone once in a while. I mean, this phone to me is like, oh, you used to talk on these things. Remember that? You know?
Yeah.
I think that the real connection to people like in person is really great. We're trying, Matresa and I have tried to get out there and get off the couch. There's so many great things to binge on TV. It's a little too easy. Mm-hmm. Our dog even likes watching TV. It's like, you know, just get out of, you know, go. But the you're right. People's lives change. You start out and you're all kind of like having a blast and you're supporting each other, your group of friends who oftentimes are musicians as well. or in some part of the music community. And then, like you said, people end up on the bus. They get on that bus and they're gone. It's a bittersweet way to put it, but the kind of family reunions for us a lot in the last few years has been when one of our pals passes away. And there's been way too much of that in the last little while. You know, there's a lot of hugging and crying, but you also remind each other, the comment is so great to see you. I hate that it's this circumstance. But in most cases, you honor the people you're there to honor. You know, invariably folks go, yeah, but it's great to see you. You call me up, let's go get a burger. Let's go pick a tune, you know, maybe even write a song, or let's go see a movie. Let's don't just talk about it. It's important. I mean, it's essential, especially in the world we live in right now, you know, personal connection. We don't get this time back, as they always say. My grandfather.
I mean, we are at an earlier phase in our life where we have young children, but the in-the-moment appreciation for the time that we are living in right now is very tangible to us. And it's what I hear you saying there. It's just like trying to hold that nugget, which kind of ties into what I heard Michaela asking about, you know, back when you were at the Troubadour and all that. I grew up idolizing that scene that you guys had, that community and that what you guys had created, whether it was consciously or circumstantially, just all being there and what was flowing through. Did you guys have an awareness then of what was going on and how special it was? Or was it just a Wednesday at the club down the street?
I think it was a combination of both. You know, we all started, in the case of our band, we started in a little club and a little music scene down in Orange County, California. Our band started in Long Beach. So there was a club down there called The Paradox that was tiny. The Bluebird looked like an arena. And it was all acoustic stuff. And there were guys like Jackson Brown, and there's a guy named Steve Noonan, and the late, great Tim Buckley, who is Jeff Buckley's dad, guys. You know, I always had to make that reference. Those guys were getting a lot of attention, Jackson and Steve and Tim. And we all ended up moving north to Hollywood, basically, where the Troubadour and the Ashgrove have two, you know, legendary clubs. And so, again, we were just still hanging out. The location changed, but the vibe remained the same. It was a little less small town being up there. When I say Hollywood, it's just a place. You know, it wasn't the Hollywood Hills. There's so many parts of Tennessee that have that sort of vista in common, you know, where you're up amongst the trees. And even though you're in the city, it feels like you're 40 miles from downtown when it's really only a couple miles, maybe. Again, I'm sure these conversations happen here as well. You know, somebody would walk into the Troubadour bar and go, I got signed. I got a deal. I'm leaving town, or I'm going to go out and open for such and such. And everybody's rooting for everybody. As people got more, I mean, we just happened to have been around folks that it sounds like, oh, I dropped something, you know, but people like Jackson Brown or Linda Ronstadt and the future Eagles. You know, I knew Bernie Ledden and I knew all those guys, Bernie, Glenn Frey, Randy Meisner. I didn't know Don Henley before they started, but I sure paid attention once I heard the music those guys were making. But when that all exploded in the early 70s, we weren't in touch as much. You know, we were all off doing our own thing. We ended up leaving. Our band moved from Los Angeles to Colorado. Part of it was we wanted to change the scene, and we had played some shows in Denver and Boulder and Evergreen, Colorado and Aspen, Colorado, which was a sleepy little ski town back then. And we just loved it. But then a bunch of people from LA started moving to Colorado. Joe Walsh moved there. The guys in the Eagles all had homes up there. The band Poco, great band. So another, here's another music scene kind of starting out there too. Certainly one of the things that dictates how the old gang breaks up a little bit is having families, and you guys know quite well, you know, people's lives change. You know, at 5 o'clock, somebody calls you, hey, come on, man.
Yeah.
Like, well, you know.
We're like, no, we're starting our dinner, bath, and bedtime routine that is going to hold us captive for the next 3-4 hours. Yeah. So.
And then it's okay.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation.
When we last saw you, we were on Kiamo, and we have two children now, but we had just one at the time, and she was 2.5, I think.
Just shy, yeah.
And it was interesting, even like on that experience on the boat, of like, we chose to bring her with us, but we had a different experience than if we had been childless. So like all of our friends, they came away from Kiamo feeling like bonded, like they all went to summer camp together and they were up late drinking and jamming. And we were like up late with a crying toddler. Like, just thinking of a whole life, we have such different phases of life that then feeds our creativity in a different way. And I'm curious about that, because it's like sometimes the energy of being amongst a lot of musicians who are all striving and starting out, like that's the energy that feeds your creative drive. Sometimes going and living in the woods and like being away from that is what your creative drive needs. Parenthood, I found, is a wealth of creative inspiration. The challenge is having the time and energy and brain capacity to channel that creative energy. But it's just like, to me, motherhood has been like, it's like the world is Technicolor now. Everything through our daughter's eyes is like amazing. And it's been such a wealth of songs, but they're so different from the songs that I used to write. Like, I always make a joke that I used to write about prostitutes and getting drunk, and like now I'm writing about my little girl. Like, so can you kind of expand on that for your experience of just like honoring those different phases of life? And, you know, if there have ever been times that you've noticed that you had to really work for your creative inspiration, or when it was, has it shifted throughout the time? Also, like, as pressures come from gaining success and needing to sustain and employing people, it's kind of a big grand question, but if anything comes to mind.
Creatively, I am the laziest guy ever. I love it when someone can come up with an idea. You know, the simplest form of that is co-writing. If you walk in the room with an idea or a title, it sure is a lot of help, or someone else does. The job of being a touring musician, which is really, you know, we're all troubadours, as they say, that's been my focus for most of my life. And when it comes to writing, I always feel like writing is a bonus time. I don't work at it as much as I should, but I love getting in a room with people and throwing down. You know, sometimes it's a long walk. I find that going to hear somebody that's really good is among the most inspiring creatively, creatively. That's easy for me to say. Let me make up a new word, creatively.
I like that.
As the bumper sticker. Yeah, I mean, that sometimes it's just the visual. Sometimes it's a guitar riff you might hear. So a lot of times it's a lyric or a film. There's a lot of stuff that can really get those juices flowing, I think. And we went on a little writing camp with some friends of ours, which wasn't intended to be a writing camp. It was just supposed to go hang out and spend some time together because they had moved out of state. We ended up writing a bunch of songs. But that was just like, what if maybe we'll write a bunch of songs? That was really cool. And the intention was, there was never a quota. There was never a end game to it. But that semi-accidental situation got me kind of more excited about writing than I've been in a very long time. The hardest place for me to come up with anything substantial is the road. And I have friends that just feed off of it and they love it. I'm just like, can I get a decent meal and enough rest? Which is, I don't want to whine about it. I love my job. And I've been really, really lucky. But paying attention, again, I've got a lot of my friends that have written great songs, either inspired by situations on the road or literally sitting in the back of the bus, you know, jotting it down or talking into your phone.
Yeah, we just had Susie Bogus on. So she was telling us about, I think actually I had emailed Gretchen when you guys were all at Gretchen's place writing.
The camp, yeah.
Yeah. Asking if she would connect me with Susie.
I love her. I love both of them.
But yeah, I feel like Jim Lauderdale is someone who talks about how he's like writing constantly, like sitting at the bar after playing a show. And we're all wired so differently. I remember when we first moved to town, I was kind of, I never really thought I wanted to do the music row, like songwriter thing, but I was kind of dipping my toes in and just getting the like, you know, you have to write every single day. Like you wake up and you write. And it took me a long time to understand that that's not how I worked and I didn't want to. And that was okay. So it was like, if I was trying to be a pop country commercial writer, then okay, maybe I need to adhere to those parameters. But I didn't want to. But there's also that difference between what are the like commercial capitalist driven dictations we're told how you need to operate creatively and like how do we just naturally operate creatively?
I think everyone's different. I always love reading about people's other folks' processes.
Mm-hmm.
That Stephen King book on writing is fabulous. Mm-hmm. You guys have probably read it. It's funny because Stephen King, really the reason that I read is Stephen King. I hated reading when I got out of high school. I'm like, I'm done with this. It's always on assignment, you know. One of the guys that I was playing music with said, man, do you ever read on the road? I'm like, yeah, I don't, you know, magazines. And he handed me the Stephen King book and I was off and running. And I am a fairly voracious reader now because of that. So he wrote this book called On Writing, which is basically his story and how he gets inspired. His process is really pretty great. But have I learned anything from it? I'm not sure. But I think it's nice to learn something every day. That's a great example. I know there are several, by the way, really great books about the process, whether it's creative writing or writing songs. Writing songs, I think, is really complicated because you're trying to make a 3-minute movie. Mm-hmm. Right. You don't have 2 hours to tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then even at that, there's so many brilliant writers that their hook is economy. When I can hear a tune that they could have said something in 20 words and they said it in 5, I'm like, ah, you just did that, didn't you? I'm just killing me.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. Gretchen and Matresa and Susie are good examples of that.
Yeah.
Harlan Howard, of course.
For sure. Yeah, that whole paradox of the simpler the line, the harder it is to find is a tough one for me to wrap my head around. You know, you're like, oh, it's so simple. It's so plain. It's so resonant. But it's so hard to actually land in that spot and land on that actual line.
It's so exciting to me. Like my body is like buzzing with excitement thinking about it because I do a lot of songwriting coaching. And when I'm working with students, I'm like, I always say, like, you need to be economical. Like, you don't have much real estate. Cut words. And how do you paint a picture with 4 words? And one of my favorite songs as an example is Charlie Rich, I Can't Even Drink It Away. To me, that song is so simple and paints like the most heartbreaking movie in my mind. I'm like that. And, you know, Lucinda Williams is always my go-to of just like
her.
She paints a picture and like a vast emotional landscape in a handful of words. But that's the like brutal challenge of writing that I think is so exciting when you finally do it. Like just switch it, like cutting 3 words and all of a sudden it's like magic. It's amazing.
Really well put, by the way. Lucinda's that thing where she can just, you know, car wheels on a gravel road. You're in a movie. The thing is so lovely, I think, about her writing, and one of the things so compelling that I know a lot of folks that have borrowed heavily from, have had a sip from that well. She's breaking convention.
Mm-hmm.
She's breaking from convention. It's not just about rhyming. I forget that a lot. Not when I'm enjoying someone else's writing or being brought in and compelled, but, you know, it's like, hell, you know, how they do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How they do it and how can I do that? Or if not, let them do it, you know?
Yeah.
Michaela Ann's new album, These Are the Days, is out now on her label Georgia June Records. This self-release marks a bold new chapter for the acclaimed singer-songwriter, and the songs reflect hard-won confidence and wisdom while still holding space for vulnerability and bravery. Written during a season of profound personal transformation, These Are the Days captures the emotional landscape of a working mother learning to find meaning in everyday life.
I look at life before and after, like this record or like motherhood, and I used to feel very much like, that's me back there and what happened to her. And I now feel like through the last few years, I'm like, oh, that was me, and now this is me. And liking this version better.
These Are the Days, available everywhere you listen to music. Order it now at michaelaann.com.
But if you let go, don't let the worries control. Count your clover, smell your roses, see how your own grass grows.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing that is sometimes hard to remember is that with songwriting, you have other elements to tell a story, not just being economical with our words, because then we also have melody and harmony and rhythm that conveys so much, which I think a writer like Lucinda is so genius at, because her songs are so catchy. Or a song like Fishing in the Dark, that song, or a lot of Lucinda songs, I'll question myself or tell students, when you write something, we might underestimate the power of the simplicity. And I'm like, go look at a Lucinda song, like Too Cool to Be Forgotten. Like, if you had written that, would you have trusted yourself that was good? Or would you have thought like, oh, this is too simple, or like Fishing in the Dark's chorus? Like, would you have thought that was too simplified or too like sentimental? And I feel like that's where the genius lies, where it's all of the parts are married together so seamlessly and tells the whole story. Or Tom Petty. If I wrote a song that was like a Tom Petty song, I'd probably be like, I don't know. I don't know if I would trust it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you have, like you said, when you have that motor, when you have that engine propelling it, when you have that series of notes, that Jerry Jeff Walker song, Mr. Bojangles, which we were lucky enough to get our hands on early on, and it still continues to kind of put gas in the bus. You know, it's been really great. But it's a wonderful song. But I remember the first time I heard it, it was the combination of chords that just killed me. Just like, ugh. We were watching a Paul McCartney thing. It was that Beatles anthology that's been running the last few weeks. You know, the whole story. They did Let It Be and had a horrible time making that record, all of them. And then they did Abbey Road. And Golden Slumbers is like, I'm getting like chills thinking about that tune right now. But it's just a melody, just, I'm welling up a little bit. It's so gorgeous. Part of it is the lyric, which is beautiful. And again, what a simple, phenomenal lyric. Smile awake you in your eyes. Oh man, it's just beautiful lullaby with all that power, you know?
Yeah.
Hit them tom-toms, Ringo, you know?
Yeah, exactly. There's so much power and there's so much movement in that song and motion those big, long, sustained notes, and then the walk down that comes after that, you know, you get whole, like, suspended feeling, and then it's, like, back to this motion, and it's, like, it's a whole journey.
It is a whole journey.
In lyric, in music, and all of it.
And I'm sure, especially knowing what we know as far as, like, what the record sounds like, if Paul McCartney were to sit at a piano and play that for us, we'd be equally moved.
Mm-hmm.
But you have the reference point now. There's something about that. What was it like, him just playing it for the guys, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of tunes that I'm not going to start naming them, but there are a lot of tunes that on the page did not look genius to me. But then when you started filling in the blanks, and sometimes literally it's the groove, right? That's where you get into that gray area between a song and a record. And then there are writers like Joni Mitchell that you want to just read them.
Mm-hmm.
Those lyrics are pretty beautiful. It's poetry just laid out for it. By the way, I'm staring at Matrace's legal pen. I'm going, that's a good song.
I wanted to ask, being married to a writer and a writer of Matrace's caliber, Matresa Burke, for any listener who doesn't know, what have you learned from her writing, but also being in partnership with her?
As far as the writing, that's literally how we got together, was to write. And that became something else. The second part wasn't immediate. I learned a lot being in a house with that force. Mm-hmm. She's been writing since, I think she says I'm like 7 years old or something. She started making up tunes, banging away on a little upright piano. And she was lucky. She wrote her first number one. I think she was 18 when she had her first number one. But she wrote it with Bobby Braddock. And she said that was such a gift, writing this tune with Bobby. It was a duet. Karen Brooks and T.G. Shepherd, called Fakin' Love. And it's kind of like, Fakin' Love, do-do-do-do-do. Is that era of country, which is kind of great.
Mm-hmm.
She lives and dies by the songwriting. She loves to play and sing. And she's a huge music fan, but writing is like the thing. So that was different for me. I'm like, hey, we got an album coming up. Maybe I'll try to write a tune or two for it.
Yeah.
But we immediately, I mean, we recorded the first two songs that Matresa and I wrote, the Dirt Band did, and she recorded one of them as well. She's got the gift. And I know, you know, as far as the partnership goes, I know it to just get out of the way and let her If she wanders off, don't bother her because she's like working on something. Or she'll come home from a writing session. I say, how'd it go? And she's like, it's such a great start, but this song is kicking my butt. You know, like you said, you're off and running. You get that first line and then you're chasing it and you're chasing it and you're chasing it. But you want to honor it. You don't want to just give up on the tune. Sometimes these things will sit around for weeks and months. And sometimes they're all done in a matter of hours. It's inspiring for me. My son, Jamie, who's been playing in our band for quite a while and who's actually been a pro in this business for a couple decades, played with some great folks like the Mavericks and Gary Allen, had a record deal on his own. And Matresa and I and Jamie have been writing together. And he's really great. And he, when he first moved to Nashville, he came here to go to school. Went to Belmont. Mainly, he was a shredder guitar player. But he would like really started paying attention to the other presence in the house, which was Matresa, and that part of things. I started the same way. I didn't care about singing. I didn't care about really writing. I just wanted to play my guitar. Words were just things that came between guitar solos. But Jamie's really, he's turned into a really fine writer, but it took a minute, you know, it took some inspiration. He had a great bit of encouragement from his dearly departed friend, Raul Malo. Raul really mentored him and took him under his wing, and they wrote a bunch of really cool songs together and kind of encouraged Jamie to like, yeah, put that guitar down now for a minute. I will say that one of Matresa's things when she and I get together to write is quit noodling on the guitar. And I can't help myself. Part of it is you need quiet, you know? And that's a good lesson. It's a hard lesson for guitar players.
I love that, though. And it's endlessly fascinating to me hearing everybody's different process and also all the different ways our brains work and relate to music. When Aaron and I were dating, we met at Jazz Conservatory, and he was a drummer. I was a singer. And like through the years, discovering like, oh, we listen to music very differently.
Very differently.
Like I listen to a song and I'm listening to the singer and not even the words that much. It's really hard for me to process lyrics without reading them. Like I can't hear a song and then sing it back often. I'm really tuned into the voice and that's what I care about. And Aaron's like, but didn't you hear the bass and the drums? And I'm like, no.
Like, the what?
That's progressed for me as I've intentionally like trained myself to listen differently as it's become my job. But it's interesting. We all kind of have different things we're drawn to and we hear things so differently.
And that's great to hear that, by the way, because I think we all share that in the studio when, you know, when everybody comes in from the room to listen to the playback. First thing you're listening for is what you did. And then, you know, you often stand around and you get somebody to raise their hand. You know, I got to punch in the bridge. And on a record, when it's your record, being able to stand back and see the entire picture is really important. We're moving out a little bit from writing, but just the recording process, I mean, the records. It's so great to just hear the, you know, instead of get that microscope and we all want to kind of sand it down so much that it's really shiny. And that is really, that's a hard one too. Seems like more often than not now, I'm in rooms where folks are going, don't change that. It's not a clam. It's, you know, Jerry Douglas says it's got a little hair on it. Leave it. It's cool.
Yep. When I'm working on records with artists, I try, you know, and this happens usually a little bit later in the process. It's like, cool, I hear that. Let's move on to this other thing. Let's focus on this and we'll come back to that. And the point being that, like, let's not get too deep in the microscope. Let's look at other things. If it doesn't catch our ear again, it's not a problem. If it continues to be like a little crack in the sidewalk that catches our toe, obviously, let's address that and fix that because, you know, we want to be able to float down the stream without hitting any rocks when we're listening to it. But like you said, yeah, getting that sandpaper out and shining it down, when you zoom out, all of a sudden, it's just like, there's nothing there anymore.
There's nothing
there. There's nothing to grab onto anymore.
Well, also, like, one of our favorite things is finding the clams on, like, Beatles records, for instance, of, like, someone hitting a wrong note. It brings so much joy.
Man, Roxanne by the Police. I've heard that song 1,000 times. It wasn't until a month. I played it for you a month ago, where Sting just sits on the piano in the first 5 seconds of the song. It's sitting there and it's got, you know, it's got the bass and the drum groove and then you just hear clang and then a little laugh. And I read it in an article. it's just Sting just kind of was in the room and he sat down on the piano.
And they left it in.
And they left it in. It's in the first 5 seconds of the song.
Oh, I got to check that out.
Right? As soon as you hear it, you'll never unhear it. But it's like, oh yeah, wow, that's weird. I never noticed. Massive hit. Never noticed. Yeah.
I love that so much. And, you know, sometimes there's intent for it to be weird, mm-hmm. you know, trying to find the one where the downbeat was in You Can Go Your Own Way. That took me a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because Mick Fleet was incredible drum part in that song. It's almost till they get to the down, da 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 da, bust into the chorus that you know, oh, but it feels good.
It
feels left footed to me. I'm always like, okay, that's cool. Ringo playing that Get Back instead of ding da da ding da, he's going dun da da dun da da. So it's leading with the one. It's not the 2 and 4. I love that stuff. But it throws you off. It wakes you up a little bit.
It does. Yeah, and with both those guys that you mentioned, Mick Fleetwood and Ringo, it's like, you know, I've had drummers be like, nah, Ringo, and they kind of shake their heads. And I'm like, no, but do you listen? Like, what he's able to play that doesn't get in the way of the song, and it makes the song what it is. It's like, think of Get Back with just a straight ahead groove on there. It's not going to feel the same. It's not going to be the same song.
It's so cool. You know, I mean, I'm sure being a drummer, you've seen that guy's Instagram feed where he says, here's the way you think you heard it. Here's what Ringo did. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's so cool because his stuff is so incredibly inventive. And of course, he's back there being Ringo and it's so cool. But man, what a mind.
Yeah.
What a mind. I mean, what, incredible. Levon Helm, Ringo, Stan Lynch. There are three guys that, and I know Stan's a huge fan of Ringo's and Levon's as well. But they're in our town, Fred Elteringham.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fred's got that thing. It's that shoulder, but I don't know.
It's part of
it's a visual, but it's just,
He's
got a great pocket. He's a great drummer. Incredible. Yeah. Good guy, too.
I love watching Fred play because if I could turn my ears off and just watch, I'm like, what is this Neanderthal guy doing behind the drums? And then if I close my eyes and listen, I'm like, this sounds and feels incredible.
Oh, man. I mean, I love Cheryl and she's incredibly magnetic, but the band is like, always just
band is insane.
That was lights out.
Yeah, when we first was it like the first couple months we were in town?
It was the first year.
Yeah, Rolling Stone Country had just gotten started, and I remember they were having their first birthday party down at Acme Feed and Seed, like on the second floor there, and Cheryl's band was playing, and I was like, oh,
yeah,
wow, because it's a little tiny room up there, and it was a private thing, so getting to just like, you know, hear that band like it was a band in the room and not, you know, on the stages that Cheryl normally plays. It's just like, every one of these people are really special.
Really special. Just,
I'm super curious, though, because I know we're nearing the end of our hour together. But for someone who, like you've said, that being on the road is your, you know, your main thing and what you really love, and you have been touring under the Farewell Tour, are you really retiring from the road?
No, yes. What we are is we're pulling the bus over to the side of the road. If you read the very first press release we put out a couple of years ago, it was essentially, we're not going to tour the way we tour.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning gone for 120 days on the road. Pretty much most of the last coming up on 60 years. And again, what an incredible ride. We're not going to stop playing, nor are we going to stop recording, but we need a hard reset. Right now, everybody's great. Even the geezers in the band are at the top of their game right now.
Mm-hmm.
But that can't, time kind of starts, you know, Clint Eastwood line about don't let the old man in. You know, Toby Keith wrote a great song with that title based on that, by the way. Mm-hmm. Love that song. Anyway, I'm grateful that everybody's healthy and happy. And we want to kind of go out on that note. We're not going to disappear. There are festivals and there might be a residency here somewhere. But to answer your question, yes. We are getting off the road. Retirement's a hard word. I don't want to retire.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that we're coming to your town, that's pretty much over. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to get out there and play to as many places that we haven't been in a long time. The response has been really lovely. Folks have been so cool. As a music fan, you know, I have all those triggers, all those, you know, those important signposts in my life. The songs that mattered when I was 10 mm-hmm. or when I was 15 or when I was 25 or last year, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm.
or 2 weeks ago. The way it feeds our souls is you can't calculate that. It's pretty amazing. And hearing people say that about our music is really humbling because, again, I got people I love. I could write pages about it, about how inspiring and how much better my life is as a result. And hearing folks say that about some experience they might have had, maybe, you know, how a song that we recorded or wrote might have had a huge impact and might have brought them some comfort mm-hmm. or might have made them just enough to get out on the dance floor, maybe, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's been really moving for us. And we're so grateful. We're really lucky. There's not a lot of us that have been doing this long that can still do it and have fun with it. So it's been a great ride.
So we'll have to make sure we haven't seen you play since Kiamo.
Yeah, we'll have to.
So we'll have to make sure we make one sometime soon.
That would be great. Love to see you guys.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, we like to wrap all these conversations up with the same thing, and you can kind of choose your own adventure. I'll give you two options for questions. And the first being something that someone has told you along the way or something that you've read that continues to resonate with you and keep your cup full, or conversely, something that you wish you knew when you were first stepping into this as a career.
This is the one where I'll really come up with a real answer next time I hop in the car and go to the grocery store.
Yeah, that happens frequently. You'd be shocked.
I know. Well, as far as before, you know, my advice, copy the people that you're inspired by and then go off to the side and make up your own version of that. Mm-hmm. And eventually that'll be an inspiration, but you'll be doing your own thing. A lot of that is coming from the singing and guitar playing side of things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think the same goes as a writer. I think that there's a trend right now with young artists, some of them at least, that get signed on the strength of their performing skills. Somebody will see them play a gig, get a record deal, and they've never written a song. Start that before. Mm-hmm. Try to work that skill alongside of the playing and the singing part. The writing's super important, I think. That's my two cents of that. You know, this is really like note to self, write a song, Jeff. and then as far as like something that's resonated for me, it's the Cowboy Jack Clements line about we're in the business of having fun. If we're not having fun, we're in the wrong business. We're not doing our job, I believe. Mm-hmm. Paraphrasing there a little bit, Cowboy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That fun part is real. And I see people I haven't run into in a while, and we're talking for a bit, and usually it's like, you still having fun. Mm-hmm. So I'm waiting for the, you know, that kind of Yoda moment. Oh, you're still having fun.
Yeah.
That's important. That's super important. It's the most inspiring thing. It's fun.
Yeah.
Watch those toddlers, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, that's like one of the pillars of motivations behind this podcast. I feel like we were just seeing in our peer group so many people behind the scenes not having fun, and already, you know, in our 30s, because the music industry is, there's so many challenging things to deal with in today's world of you have to do all the business yourself. And that's been kind of my motto in the past couple years of like, I want it to be fun again, even the like promoting and the releasing and like trying to stay rooted and have fun. How do we have fun with this? What's the point otherwise?
That is a good point. And not to, you know, make light of it and just go, it's just fun. There are things we got to do. We all have chores and you got to do those chores, you know. But I think, again, what we touched on a little while ago, being in the moment, it's such a cliche. But think about when you're hanging out with people you love and you enjoy their company, invariably now, especially, somebody will say, how lucky are we right now? Mm-hmm. Just don't forget what this feels like.
Yeah.
You know, finding some joy. And sometimes you can find joy in like doing the dishes or folding laundry.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Entirely.
Yeah.
Or walking your dog, you know, putting your kid to bed, getting out the bumper sticker material. the Cowboy Jack quote to me, you know, we're in the fun business. That's so good. We can all get bogged down. And to be fair, when I started doing what I'm doing, the word content wasn't a thing. I mean, Gretchen Peters had, I don't know if she came up with that. She posted something a while back about, you know, the pressure of filling up the space, period, especially in the virtual space, constantly. Mm-hmm. How do you do the part that feeds your soul? Mm-hmm. When it's like, we need more content, need more stuff, and attention spans, yada, yada, yada. It's a lot harder. I am very grateful that a lot of that stuff didn't exist when we started. We had big, giant telephones, and they weren't portable.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's part of the, you know, it's part of the game, and you guys have done a good job of navigating those waters, mm-hmm. and I commend you, applaud you for that. It's part of the gig now. People used to be mysterious. Remember that?
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
No mystery longer. There's no mystery. In fact, it's like, oh no, don't show me that. Don't, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us. And we're so happy to get to talk to you.
It's great talking to you guys. Yeah. Nice to see you again.
You Likewise. Too. Please give our love to Matresa as well.
I will.
Say hello. Thank
right.
you, Jeff.
All right, Jeff. Take care.
Adios. Nice to see you guys.
You Likewise. Too.
We know your time is valuable, and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel, or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, J.D. McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Pod Punch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.